How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here on a Tuesday morning. It's 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs. We'll play them later. You request the bumps. We play them. And it's 2 for Tuesday. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We are going to talk about the onslaught of Generation Z, which is coming to get us. We're also going to talk about reality shows. There's a little controversy about Gordon Ramsay that we're going to get into. Plus, we're going to play a round of For the Record. Skip Skipley is on the way, so we'll do a little For the Record coming up later on in the show. As always, our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 2 for Tuesday requests. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Welcoming back to the show, one of my favorite guests, Beverly Gray. She's the author of several books. She writes about film on her Beverly in Movieland blog. Her latest book, Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation, is available now. And you can check out all the information, her blog, and the website at beverlygray.com, G-R-A-Y, beverlygray.com. We'd like to have Beverly on just to talk movies and entertainment in general. And it's always a pleasure to have Beverly back on the show. Beverly, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
Good. I'm glad. Tell everybody about how you got your start. Again, just to remind everybody, you did indeed work for Roger Corman for a period of time.
I did, and it's a wonderful story because I was getting a PhD in English at UCLA, and out of the blue, I got a call via one of my professors that a filmmaker wanted to talk to me about a possible job. And when I heard the name Roger Corman, I, of course, said, who's Roger Corman? Because I was a literary type of person, right. And I didn't go around watching monster movies, so right. I learned.
And you worked for him. You wrote a terrific book about it, too, about your experiences. And it's called Bloodsucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers, Roger Corman. So, yeah, just a great story. That's when we first had you on to talk about that book. And since then, we'd love to have you on just to talk about your blog and what you're writing about and movies and things like that. A couple of blog posts that you most recently put up. Let's talk a little bit about The World of Merchant Ivory. You wrote about The World of Merchant Ivory, and it was interesting. I have to say, Beverly, that I was stunned that James Ivory had never won an Oscar before last year. I have to say,
right,
that I was stunned by that, considering the kind of output that Merchant Ivory had.
Right. Fabulous films, beautiful films, films which had won their own awards of various kinds. And, of course, I'm blanking on all the names right now.
Well, there's Room of the View, and there's
Room of the View, yes.
Remains of the Day. There's Howard's End, Remains of the Day. I mean, just it's title after title of these really prestigious, wonderfully, beautifully put together movies that were critically acclaimed and were nominated for awards. And that's why when Ivory won last year and they said it was his first time, I couldn't believe it.
That's right. And interestingly enough, he was the director of the pair, the Merchant Ivory pair.
Yeah.
But in this case, the award he won was for screenwriting.
Yes.
So it goes to show that you never know what's coming in your life.
Yeah.
The other members of that famous triumphant merchant, who is from India, was the producer. Ivory, who is from the United States, was the director. And they had a screenwriter as well, a very interesting lady. The more I read about her, the more fascinated I am. And I'm not going to pronounce anything right, but Ruth Praver Javala, mm-hmm, who was a Holocaust survivor, Jewish Holocaust survivor from Germany, who married a man from India and went on to become a marvelous screenwriter, adept at turning strongly literary novels into wonderful screenplays.
Yeah. Yeah, and you recently, you were inspired to write a little bit about Merchant Ivory because you recently rewatched Room with a View.
Yes, and it is so gorgeous, and it's so elegantly done. And, of course, almost every wonderful British actor from a certain generation that you can think of is in it. Helena Bonham Carter and Denham Elliott and... Wait a second, Daniel Day-Lewis,
right,
and
Judy Dench.
And on. Judy,
yep,
Dench.
Yep.
Oh, and of course the wonderful, wonderful Maggie Smith.
She's so great.
It's funny, it's sweet, it captures the spirit of the E.M. Forster novel, And look, I was an English major. Of course I go for movies like that.
Yeah.
I think the Academy as a whole liked and admired them, and some performance awards were won by people in those films, but they weren't quite at the top of the heap. They were not kind of maybe American enough or vigorous enough. They're elegant, literate movies.
Yeah, they are. And consistent, too. If that was the one thing about the Merchant Ivory movies, you knew what you were going to get, and you were going to get quality, and you were going to get class. Every time you saw one, and it was no question about it. I have to say, my personal favorite, and of all the Merchant Ivory movies, is Remains of the Day. I the performances in that movie are so unbelievable, and that movie had the distinct problem of being released the same year as Schindler's List, when clearly that was going to take the most of the prizes. But I think in any other year, it could have swept the Academy Awards. But I think Hopkins is great in it. Temp Thompson is great in it. It's just all the way around. I love that movie.
It's a beautiful movie, a movie with so much going on beneath the surface. Interestingly enough, that is one. That's a contemporary novel. It isn't a novel from the 19th century,
right,
or the very early 20th century.
Right.
But it's a novel set in that time. It has that kind of Downton Abbey suppressed desire kind of quality
it. Yeah, yeah. I think it's one of Hopkins' most restrained and beautiful performances. I think he's beautiful in it. It's heartbreaking, and I've always been a fan of it. Now, it's quite a difference, as you point out in the piece. There's quite a difference between these Merchant Ivory films that we're talking about, like Howard's End and The Remains of the Day and Room with a View, than Call Me by Your Name, which is a beautiful film. Call Me by Your Name, an absolutely beautiful film, but completely different in terms of what you would expect from James Ivory.
Yes. Well, I guess I would say yes and no. There are things in that film, and of course, Call Me by Your Name, the central focus of it is this, I guess you'd say, this love that dares not speak its name.
Yeah.
It's a very old phraseology,
sure.
But it's a gay love story. And certainly there were intimations of that sort of thing in some of their earlier films, which was completely natural for James Ivory and Ishmael Merchant,
sure,
who were partners in all senses of the word.
Right.
But it wasn't something that they brought forward, that they put at the front. Although I guess they did once, because they made a film of Maurice, or the British would say Morris,
right,
the E.M. Forster novel,
right,
where he lets it all hang out a bit more than he was usually wont to do.
Yeah. It is. I mean, I've not read the book of Call Me by Your Name, but it's a beautiful screenplay and really well done, and he deserved the Oscar for it. And it was about time. Again, like I said, when I was watching the Academy Awards in February, when they said it was his first Academy Award, I was really stunned. And I think the Merchant Ivory team deserved more accolades from the Academy than they got, which is I think too bad.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the things that can be lovely about the Oscars, and we can say all sorts of bad things about the Oscars,
yeah,
and people do all the time, but it's really nice when there's someone who has a kind of a legacy who finally gets honored. That is, I think, the nicest thing.
Agreed.
That happens on
Agreed.
Some of those broadcasts.
Agreed. Another blog post that you put up, a sad story, L.A. food critic Jonathan Gold passed away.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And there's a documentary about him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a documentary which is called City of Gold,
mm-hmm,
and of course I had to go to see it. And I was kind of stunned how much press there was from all over the country after he died,
yeah,
because, of course, he's a local food critic, but he was a local food critic who was the first and only ever food critic who's won a Pulitzer Prize.
Right.
And what's interesting about, and when he won that Pulitzer Prize, he was not on staff at the LA Times, which is what he was at the time of his death. He was writing for a little local paper called the LA Weekly, and that was very, very cool that somebody could be recognized for writing for a kind of a funky local paper and covering not so much the gourmet hangouts and the Michelin star kind of places, but the mom and pop restaurants and the food trucks and the ethnic culture that makes Los Angeles a great place to eat, frankly. So, yeah. You know, he discovered it was a great place to eat. He was an L.A. native. And the story that I heard him tell on the radio once was that he grew up in a neighborhood, frankly, not far from where I grew up. And so I knew what he was talking about. I think he was a student at UCLA at the time, and he was taking the bus back and forth. So he'd get off the bus, and each time he got off the bus, he got off a little further from his home because he was starting to discover all these cool little mom-and-pop restaurants he hadn't known were there. So he was a great one for discovering, you know, the great little Filipino place that made something that nobody else had,
right,
or the exotic Chinese place, or place with food from El Salvador with, of course, authentic ingredients and the spirit of the country from which its owners and proprietors came. So that's really what the movie's about. It did show him going to some of the elegant places that a food critic does go to, but more him dropping in on, you know, the mama-san and the various other ethnicities, all the cultural people whom he was friends with, whom he became friends with. They loved him, and he loved not only the food, but the communities in which the food was lovingly prepared.
Yeah.
So he was someone who did something different from your classic movie critic. In my blog post, I mentioned the one in the movie Ratatouille,
right,
the one who is voiced by Peter O'Toole,
right.
Anton Ego.
Right.
And the name says it all.
Right.
The man who was snobbish and pedantic and everything else, effete. Jonathan Gold was not that kind of guy.
Right.
He was a man of the people. He loved everyone. He loved to eat everything. And he died shockingly quickly of pancreatic cancer.
That's
apparently
too bad.
He was diagnosed, and he died 3 weeks later.
It's terrible.
Stunning.
That's terrible. But the film is the film.
I've got to say, pancreatic cancer, which killed my father, I'm afraid, also was what carried off Aretha Franklin. So
right.
It's an unforgiving and a horrible disease.
It certainly is. But the film is called City of Gold, and people can see it. It came out about 3 years ago.
Yeah, but
okay.
That's about right.
Okay.
It's a lot of fun, and it'll show you some things about L.A. that you may not know.
Great. Okay. Beverly, hang on, okay?
Sure.
Okay, Beverly Gray is with us. She's great. She's the author of several books. She writes about film on her Beverly in Movie Land blog. Her latest book is called Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, and it's a terrific book all about The Graduate. We're going to talk more with Beverly right after we take this break on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And it is a Tuesday morning. That means it's 2 for Tuesday. Time to get your requests in now. One artist, two songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Beverly Gray is currently my guest. She is the author of several books. She writes about film on her Beverly in Movie Land blog. You can check out beverlygray.com. We have a link on our Facebook page, too, at facebook.com/NickDShow. And we welcome Beverly back. Beverly, welcome back.
Thank you.
So you wrote a piece about a stage performance that you saw with Jeremy Irons and Leslie Manville. Wow.
Yes. Yes, was I lucky.
Oh, man, tell me about that. Tell me all about that, Beverly.
Okay. My goodness, we're being literary this evening. they were performing in a production of the Eugene O'Neill classic, Long Day's Journey Into Night.
Mm.
So it's another case of English actors discovering and doing a heck of a job with American classic theater.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, this is a play written by O'Neill very late in his own life, mm-hmm. refused to have it produced in his own life, because basically it's his family story, and it explains all the things that were eating this very talented but very troubled playwright, a mother who was a morphine addict, a father who was a kind of a ham actor, who was kind of over the hill, a brother who was an alcoholic, and so on. So it's not fun in games, although this production certainly had its lighter moments. And what you really need, it's a production with basically four characters. There's also a maid who comes in and out, but basically four characters doing a whole lot of talking. But when they're actors like these, you are in awe of what they manage to convey. Leslie Manville is someone I had never heard of until The Phantom Thread,
right?
Where I thought she was just fascinating, where she seemed to be, you know, the expression "still waters run deep." That seemed to be what was going on.
Yeah.
There was lots going on in her,
mm-hmm.
and she was quite fascinating in this. One of the things, as she slips into drug-induced delirium in the course of this play, you see something you almost didn't expect to see, which is the young woman whom this famous actor fell in love with long ago. And the girlishness, the charm that's there side by side with the pain and the disillusionment and all those other qualities. It was a wonderful performance. It was a real thrill to see it.
I had never really, I mean, I had seen her in a couple of films, but nothing like what she did in Phantom Thread. I mean, that, and, you know, ended up getting an Oscar nomination for it as well. And she was an amazing performance in that film. And I had to go back to remember seeing her in just a couple of small roles in other movies. But, wow, what a performance. And to see her live on stage. And Jeremy Irons on stage,
yeah,
live, that must have been something, too.
It was indeed. And, of course, Jeremy Irons' role is that of someone who's a ham actor who had been a very, very successful actor. Eugene O'Neill's father had been in the company of people like Edwin Booth. I mean, it was one of the greats of his day, in a kind of hammy theatrical,
yeah,
way. So an actor, I think, has a great time playing an actor of that kind,
yeah,
who's sort of florid and self-forgiving, and but again with the real emotions beneath the theatrical gestures.
Yeah, he is a consummate professional and such a great actor. I've always loved Jeremy Irons. I've loved my favorite Jeremy Irons performance is still Dead Ringers, the David Cronenberg film.
Oh my God! That is a creepy movie.
It is a creepy movie. Let me tell you really quickly, Beverly. I took a girl on a first date to see that movie. It didn't go well.
Yeah, I suspect it didn't go well.
Oh, no, but anyway, the thing about that, the thing that's extraordinary about that performance is that for people who might not know, he plays twin drug addicted gynecologists in this movie, which right there is enough to tell you that it's not a good first date film. But he's so good in the movie that you can tell which character is which without him even doing anything. You know what I mean? Like he made,
yeah,
them so distinctly different. It's a tremendous performances. Two great performances in that one movie.
I agree with you completely.
Yeah, he's great. Now, let's talk a little bit about some movies that you've seen recently. It opens here in Chicago Friday, but you've seen Juliet Naked. Can you tell me a little bit about it, because I'm curious about it. I like the cast and you know, I know that Judd Apatow produced it and I'm just wondering what you think of it.
I enjoyed it. It's not, I believe that I said afterward to my significant other, I really enjoyed this. I don't think I'm going to remember it very well tomorrow.
And,
it's got quite a title. The title doesn't, of course, fit the movie, but not in the ways you would think.
Right.
And it's not, there's certainly sex suggested and discussed in it, but it's not a sexy movie. It's a rather poignant movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a romantic comedy, and I like those. I gravitate toward movies in which things seem hopeful. But it has a very interesting premise. It's also based on a Nick Hornby novel, and
right,
Nick Hornby has done some very cool things, like High Fidelity being one of them.
About a boy as well, yeah.
Yes, yes. Just interesting relationships. And speaking of which, in passing, there is a boy, a little boy in this, because the character played by Ethan Hawke is a rock star and almost megastar from the 90s who kind of disappeared and who is the object of cult veneration by a lot of rather flaky internet people, including the significant other of the female lead in the movie, whose name suddenly escapes.
Rose Byrne.
Thank you, Rose Byrne, right. Yes, who is so pretty. And she's a little tired of hearing about this incredible guy and what happened to him, and you know, her partner, is obsessing over bootleg tapes of this one famous recording session. And then somehow the actual guy, Tucker Crowe, mm-hmm. comes, played by Ethan Hawke, comes into her life in a roundabout way. And what's interesting about him is he's a guy who is really screwed up and knows it, who you don't find all the details out for a while.
Yeah.
When you do, I think it's pretty satisfying. But a guy who has had obviously a great many girlfriends / groupies, mm-hmm. who has fathered a great many children, and who belatedly has decided to kind of clean up his act. So to the youngest child, he is wonderful. In fact, he's pretty much his entire life revolves around being a great dad to this youngest kid. But various other of the offspring come into the movie and gives it a quality it doesn't usually have as a romantic comedy.
Well, good. I'm looking forward to it. It opens here in Chicago on Friday. Always looking forward to it. Beverly, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's just great. And your website is beverlygray.com, G-R-A-Y. And we'll talk to you soon sometime. Have a great week.
Thank you.
All right, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Beverly Gray, she's just charming and wonderful. All right, we'll take a break. We got the news coming up next on WGN.